Let's go ahead and get into this. Everybody have an outline with them? Okay. How about we start with a word of prayer? Yeah, I think we're on here. All right, Father God, we thank you so much for this time and the chance to get together to go through these worldviews and find out why they just don't work. And Lord, we ask that you would help us and guide us and teach us why your truth is the only truth, God. And we just thank you for this opportunity. Guide our minds and our hearts. In Jesus' name, amen. So I have a bit of a cold going here, so I didn't do as much as I usually do in preparation for tonight. So hopefully you'll bear with me as I fumble through this. I'm about 75% right now. So if you can just give me grace, I'd appreciate that. So at the beginning here, you'll see this kind of chart. You saw this last week where we kind of threw together how these worldviews seem to relate to each other and build off of each other through the centuries. We already looked at the ones before 1900, and actually last week we looked at logical positivism there on the right. And what we didn't do was nihilism, which is what we'll do tonight. And I added that to the 1800s mark there. So basically what you can see is that with naturalism, nihilism, skepticism, empiricism, scientism, all of these worldviews we've already discussed and critiqued and refuted, they all seem to be heading us into the last century. And we will see how they transform themselves into the worldviews that we encounter today. And so if you look at the second bunch of diagrams there, you can see how logical positivism basically translates to language games, which we haven't talked about, and structuralism, which we won't talk about. We won't talk about language games either. But we'll talk about pragmatism, we'll talk about postmodernism, and then we'll talk about relativism and pluralism. And all of these things build off of each other as you go through the last 100 years. But also, another track is taking place, which we'll learn tonight, we'll get into tonight. So nihilism leads to existentialism, which also leads to postmodernism and relativism and pluralism. So with logical positivism and nihilism, we still get to kind of the same place from two different starting points. And that's kind of the basic idea with these diagrams here. It's just to show you that really what we're trying to get to are relativism and pluralism, because that's really what we meet on the street most often. Everyone seems to have a naturalistic framework, this scientistic type of mindset where science gives the ultimate truth. People are very skeptical of their own senses, of their own rationality, especially the rationality that most of the culture holds. And we've already looked at why those worldviews fail. However, they persist in our culture. So that's the idea, is that nihilism is also causing the same cultural phenomena that we experience today. And we're going to see that later on. As next week we'll get into existentialism, which is a direct response to nihilism. In my email earlier this week, you may have read that this week we were supposed to do secular humanism, but I replaced it with nihilism. Actually, it's quite the opposite. This week we were supposed to do existentialism, and next week secular humanism. So not to confuse you any further, the point is we're doing nihilism to existentialism, and then I'm probably going to give you secular humanism as a handout, and you could take it and just read it, or I'll email it to you as a PDF, and either we won't meet that week, or we'll move the classes, we'll move the next topic into that week. Does that make sense? So you guys can kind of think about that. Let me know what you want to do with the secular humanism one. All right, now let's talk about the basic ideas held by many Western non-Christians. you may encounter this as a route to the person's worldview, or kind of background info to the person's worldview. So they may hold to something like, there is no ultimate purpose, there is no ultimate meaning, and there is no objective morality. So they may have a worldview that is based on these things. They probably won't say these things, but they may say something like, it doesn't matter anyway, does it? Or things don't really matter in the long run. You know, you may hear it come out like that. But essentially, these are the points that they're holding to, which is when they express that, nothing really matters. Or I can get away with it because it, you know, it doesn't matter anyway. That's where this is coming from. There is no ultimate purpose in the universe. There is no ultimate meaning. And there is no objective morality. So if you have like a college student who's partying it up one night, you know, and he's got a choice to get drunk, or, you know, these days they just put a roofie in some girl's glass and take advantage of the sorority girl or something like this, you know, they may say to their buddy, hey, it doesn't really matter anyway, does it? You know, we can get away with it, so it's okay. In other words, there's no objective morality that they're violating. They're not going against something that stands apart from them, objectively speaking, that they're going against. They're violating. So this is the idea, is that people try to get away with things. We try to rationalize. We try to justify our behavior. And when we can make sense of these three premises, or if these three premises fit well holistically and coherently within our overarching worldview, then we could get away with our immoral actions. And we can call our immoral choices and decisions amoral or non-moral, meaning that if there is no ultimate meaning, and if there is no objective morality, then what traditionally we think of as moral is a non-moral issue. So what is now in our culture considered repulsive, kind of like Dennis Prager was talking about the other night, these are just amoral issues, non-moral issues. Okay, so by way of background, how do we understand nihilism? How do we understand these basic concepts? There is no ultimate purpose, no ultimate meaning. Well, you may be asking, well, why do I even need to learn about meaninglessness, or why do I need to learn about objective morality? I'll give you two reasons. One is that everyone needs meaning. We are very meaningful-oriented creatures. We all seek meaning, and we seek it most when we go through hard times. Have you ever been through a hard time? Anybody? You know, these are the times when we seek meaning the most. We don't usually seek meaning when we're working, we have a job, we're busy, we like our job, we think we're making a difference with our work. We seek meaning. We start to ask the meaning questions of life. Does my life have purpose? When things get really rough, and I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. So when we're faced with tragedy and suffering, we just long to know how this pain is meaningful. Is it worth it to go through this? Am I getting any better by going through this suffering? We ask these questions during those times. And so when we watch other people go through hard times, especially lots of people, we ask these questions a lot. I remember when I was in Uganda, actually, about 5 years ago. Have any of you been to Uganda? Okay, so you may know that the LRA had taken basically all of northern Uganda under its control. And, you know, 20 years ago or so, they started this campaign to basically cause people to become child soldiers by killing their parents in front of them and then cutting their ears and nose and then forcing them to join this rebel army. Basically, they were just criminal gangsters. And so they rampaged all of northern Uganda. And consequently, the government put many of the people there in refugee camps. So I had the opportunity of going there, and this was very much popularized by Invisible Children. You may know that organization. So I had the opportunity to go there and volunteer in some of these refugee camps and do some basic stuff, praying for people too and sharing the gospel while we were there. And when we went from place to place and just doing stuff with like some local hospitals, like you tend to feel like you're making a big difference in that moment. But then when you come back, I don't know if you've ever experienced this coming back from a mission trip, you tend to go through this despair phase, like your mind is debriefing itself in a way that causes you to have this existential dread, and that you consider all of what you did and all of what everybody does to be meaningless. So it's kind of this state of depression. Have any of you ever experienced a state of depression in any sort of way? Where you just feel like life is meaningless? You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Where did you go?
Yeah, that was just Romania.
Romania, okay.
That was my first South trip. And it was Orthodox.
Okay.
Basic ministry was, and there's a history to that because of the government that they had and what they made women do and force, pregnancies and so forth. So now,
yeah.
Romania, Bucharest, Street Children.
Yeah. You felt like you were making a difference.
All of us, it feels like the drum. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
It was, yes.
Yeah.
It was in what we did with the kids and the orphanages, what we brought.
Yeah.
I mean, we just brought so much stuff with us.
Yeah. So you had the opportunity to really love on them and
yes.
care. And it's very fulfilling.
Especially the teenagers and the teenage boys. And I remember one night I was there just talking and listening to the teenage boys. And I stayed up all night. And just listening to them and the questions that they had. And they're not really well off.
Yeah. It's a amazing thing when you go on these mission trips. I'm sure you can identify with what Sony's talking about, this sense of amazing fulfillment that you're making this incredible difference in these people's lives, and then you come back and you feel like, wow, I just made this huge difference. I feel very fulfilled, but there's a bill, 7 billion other people, that really need this kind of loving, and care. And I think that a lot of us come through these weird stages of, what would you call that? Integration with this culture, reintegrating. Yeah.
Detox.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
I did not get what I thought I should get, and I had 55 missions, and I was destroying lives and putting people potentially in harm's way, wiping out the village. And I was depressed. Motherhood and apple pie, certainty, God, country, blah, 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 no, we were filled with it all, and I wasn't the only one.
Yeah.
And so the sense of depression is interesting, you see.
Yeah.
You know, here I am, and I'm doing this for the good of the world.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you for opening up, Roger and Sony. And we all seem to identify with these basic human needs, and whether it's just a little bit of depression or a lot of it, I think we all have kind of been there, where we are so distracted by this other thing, whether it's another country or another people group that we saw suffering, it's hard to make sense of what's in front of us here. It feels like a weight that is so heavy, we just cannot lift it. And therefore, everything else just stops in our life. We just exist, but we don't do, We kind of just barely be, but we don't thrive, And I think you can all identify with this. The point that we're trying to make here is that when we talk to people in the streets, a lot of times people have dealt with this personal meaninglessness, and we can connect with them there because we also have, and of course with Christianity we have a beautiful solution to meaninglessness. Where nihilism comes into the picture is you have here a very academic sense of meaninglessness. It's an academic force, if you will, that goes through culture at the high level in academia. And so when we talk about meaninglessness here, we're going to be dealing with it in a kind of a different sense than the depression sense. Because I would love to talk about that with you for an hour and a half, but unfortunately we signed up for a different class, so we're going to do this. But that is equally important, to understand someone's sense of meaninglessness that they've encountered. So given that, the second reason is the worldview we encounter today came from a worldview of meaninglessness called nihilism. And like I said, in order to understand existentialism and postmodernism, we need to understand nihilism. And so when philosophers talk about meaninglessness with humanity, they call it the human condition or the human predicament. I think you may have mentioned that, Roger, already. So nihilism says that it's not meaningless because we suffer, but it's meaningless because God is no longer in the picture. It's meaningless because God is no longer in the picture. So our meaninglessness is not suffering dependent, like we know of in a day-to-day sense, but it's God dependent. If God is there, then we have meaning. If he's not, then we don't. So existentialism then comes later as a response to nihilism. So in order to understand existentialism, we have to understand this, because that's where morality really gets out of control, is with existentialism. So what is nihilism? Let's look at this in more detail. Well, the root of the word is nihil, Latin for nothing. So you could think of nihilism as nothingism. So here's a nice definition. James Sire, he wrote a great book that sold about 350,000 copies starting in the 70s called The Universe Next Door. And in it, he basically beats up on a lot of secular worldviews. He says this a nihilism. Nihilism is a denial of any philosophy or worldview, a denial of the possibility of knowledge, a denial that anything is valuable. Nihilism is the negation of everything, knowledge, ethics, beauty, reality. In nihilism, no statement has validity, nothing has meaning. So what he's saying here is that when you hold to nihilism, this nothingism, you're saying that nothing at all exists or is valuable or is meaningful. Nothing at all is. Of course, nobody holds that view, so really we don't want to camp out there. We want to camp out on the part of nihilism that affects existentialism and postmodernism. So the way we're going to get to that is by taking nihilism and breaking it down. So nothing of a category exists. So that is, there is no such entities in a certain category considered. So when we think about the category of, say, baseball, in baseball, there are no footballs. Okay, pretty basic, right? So in the category of baseball, there are no footballs. Or in the category of smartphones, there are no such things as zebras. Okay, you don't put a zebra in the same category as a smartphone. In the category of naturalism, you don't have any supernatural entities like God, right? Like we talked about. So for nihilism, in the category of the universe, no values or meaning exist. That's the idea with that. So when you think about the universe and all that it is in it, we look around and we say, oh, well, it seems like we know this, and these things are meaningful, and this holds true. But in reality, we don't know for sure, because we're stuck in the box too. We're in this category with nature. So the only way we really know the truth about nature is if somebody from outside the box tells us what's the correct perspective in our box, right? So nihilism says there's no such thing as a supernatural being outside of our box that can tell us what is in our box accurately. All we can do is look around and see what's in our box and just say, well, we think this is in our box. But what nihilism says, there's nothing that gives us the correct perspective. There's no way to know, ultimately, the truth. There's no way to know if there is any meaning. We just think there are meanings, But these are just ways we think about things, ways that we express things. We don't really know because we can't get outside of our box with naturalism. So nihilism denies the possibility of clarifying, differentiating, and distinguishing moral values. So you can't really take moral values and break them down. You can't clarify right and wrong or gray areas. You can't differentiate and say there's any way to know what's a really evil thing and what's just a semi-evil thing and what's a kind of good thing and what's a really good thing and what's a super good thing. You can't break this down and create a spectrum of morality. So morality and values are foundationless in nihilism. So you know how we talked about foundationalism and realism? Well, foundationalism says you don't need anything else beyond this point to justify your entire structure of knowledge. There's no other thing that you need to justify for your foundation. You don't have to have any other criteria to use to justify your foundation. Well, nihilism says that there is no foundation. So think of a skyscraper on concrete foundations, say a big mat slab. In LA, we use mat slabs about 10 feet thick sometimes. In Chicago, we use mat slabs of concrete with caissons that go into the earth, these cylindrical piles that go into the earth about 70 feet because the soil there is even worse. And so in this sense, if nihilism is saying there is no foundation under your skyscraper, nothing. So you just push that skyscraper a little bit and it's going to fall. That's the idea with nihilism, is your moral structure has no foundation. It's collapsing as we speak. Therefore, you can't even begin to consider differentiating and creating a moral spectrum, which you start to discern behaviors, actions, and whatnot. So the two forms of nihilism that we're concerned with is ethical nihilism and existential nihilism. So with ethical nihilism, this is pretty simple. Morality is meaningless. That's what ethical nihilism is. It makes sense, ethical nihilism. So there are no morals in this sense. Anything, any conversation about morals is just a meaningless sort of conversation, kind of like we talked about last week, where we talked about how religious talk about God is, we are charged with that talk being meaningless. In this sense, morality is meaningless. You could skip those definitions or read them over the weekend, but the point is just that. And then with existential nihilism, you have life is meaningless. Life is meaningless. Okay, and we'll get into existentialism more later. You could read those definitions on your own time. Yes? Okay, what do you mean? Ooh, that is a very good point. Yes, you're very right. Anything they do or say it creates meaning. But we're going to get to that in a second. So hold that, in the second half. So hold that thought. That's a great point. So how did nihilism develop? Well, it's been around since the ancient Greeks, just like everything else has. They were just brilliant people back then, even though they liked to chill around the Mediterranean and do their thing. This ancient Italian philosopher, Gorgias, is famous for having said, nothing exists. If anything did exist, it could not be known. If it was known, the knowledge of it would be incommunicable. So way back then, 500 almost years before Christ, or 400 or so, he was known for having said that. So it's been around for a while. You see it in Shakespeare's Macbeth and other things. But more recently, as we saw with naturalism coming to the forefront in Europe, especially right after Darwin's Origin of Species, you see naturalism really gaining ground in the public mind. It really set the stage for cultural change, naturalism did. And naturalism, like we just were talking about, begins and concludes with the view that God is unnecessary to explain it all. So recall these definitions with naturalism, if you remember when we talked about this. The universe requires no supernatural cause for explanation. but can be explained with the understanding that is self-existent, self-operating, and self-directing. The worldview processes are not teleological or anthropocentric, but purposeless and deterministic. And last part of naturalism's definition is that every aspect of human life is an ordinary natural event attributable to nature. So we humans are determined to have no free will, and we are just part of some bigger mechanism. So with naturalism, you don't have a supernatural. Everything is naturally caused, it's self-explanatory. The world's processes are not teleological, meaning they don't have any purpose in mind. They just happen the way they happen. They just flow because cause and effect causes, you know, creates this unfolding world that we now see. And so the naturalistic processes are all we need to understand what is happening in the world. Nothing beyond the naturalistic processes. So the implication of naturalism is we actually see that we are here unnecessarily. So if you take God out of the picture, who's a necessary being by definition, then the universe and all that we see around us is unnecessary, including ourselves. So once you lose our necessary source, then everything else becomes unnecessary. It could have been otherwise. In fact, when we examine the rest of the universe, it seems that we are the only ones here. The improbabilities of our existence are astronomically high. We are, in this sense, a cosmic accident. We are a cosmic accident according to naturalism. So the naturalist says nothing except the cosmological constants and life permitting features the way they are. They just happen to be that way. And so we're in a sense lucky to be alive. We're lucky that the cosmological constants are the way they are in the universe, or we wouldn't be here. So in that sense, we're lucky. Naturalists hold that we are products of the universe. We are just part of the universe. The universe gave birth to us. That we are, in that sense, animated stardust. Animated stardust. Listen to this quote from a famous cosmologist, an atheist cosmologist. He says, We who are children of the universe, animated stardust, can nevertheless reflect on the nature of that same universe, even to the extent of glimpsing the rules on which it runs. So in this weird sense, we are products of the universe, but yet we can reflect on the universe. We have an awareness that no one else seems to have in the universe. Nothing else, no animal, no other rock or star seems to have this self-reflecting nature. But we do. Isn't that odd? We can critique naturalism to death. In fact, we already did that. But it's one of my favorite things to do. But the point is that if nature is our maker, then we, as animated stardust, ought to have the permission to ask of nature, what are we here for? And when we do ask that question to nature, what does nature say? Nothing. It is silent. So we who are animated stardust have this awareness, and we ask, well, why are we here? And we get no response. We just have this cosmic sense of aloneness. And so because we all live and die, and the entire human race goes out of extinction, and the entire earth will die a heat death, it doesn't matter what we do in the here and now, because there's no ultimate purpose. So whether we all lived and died 30 years, and we're all humanity was dead, let's say, in 30 years, then it doesn't appear that anything mattered with that group called humanity. Well, in this sense, we're here for, well, I don't know, 10,000 years, 50,000 years, depending on if you're an old Earth creationist or young Earth creationist. But either way, you kind of think about it and you say, wow, you know, if, say, the universe was just a burn up and we'd die a heat death or cold death, it kind of seems to make sense to say that nothing we do or did mattered. And that is kind of what naturalism is leading us towards, isn't it? If you take God out of the picture, all we have is this existence where we live and we die, and nothing we do really matters, because we're going to all die anyway. We're all going to be annihilated, and the earth is going to move closer to the sun and burn up, or we're just going to freeze to death, you know, whatever. I'm trying to depress you. This was the depressing night. So even if we're just annihilated at death, if you believe in annihilation and not immortality, or having any sort of afterlife, and some Christians hold to annihilation for the unsaved, even in this sense, if you're a naturalist, if your life kind of sucks, you may be looking forward to that annihilation. You know, and so you kind of start to get this sense that with naturalism, whether it's the heat death of the universe or the cold death, or with just your own personal death, it's easy to conclude that nothing matters. All right, so now with naturalism, you see here in this diagram, kind of with the arrows to the right, that naturalism kind of leads to scientism, plus this unnecessary God situation, which leads to metaphysical nihilism, which leads to ethical nihilism. Okay, so that's our point of concern. And with skepticism, you kind of have a similar train of thought or a flow of thought. Scientism plus your unknowable God leads to epistemological nihilism, meaning that there are no such thing as there is no such thing as knowledge. So that's epistemological, because how we know things, right? Epistemological. All right. So the first reason that naturalism turns into nihilism is that naturalism does not supply a basis on which a person can act significantly. What we do in this matter, in this world, does not matter. There's no significance to our actions. That's ultimately how naturalism turns into nihilism. Okay? The second reason is because for naturalism, God is not necessary if we can explain the entire order of the universe without God. So that's the second way naturalism turns into nihilism. Okay, again, without God, and you can explain everything else, then ultimately you just get to nihilism, that nothing matters. Everything is meaningless. And the last reason is that you cannot get an ought from an is. You cannot get an ought from an is. What do I mean by that? Well, you cannot get a morality, which you can call the ought, how we ought to be, let's say, from the naturalistic way of the world, which is the is. So you cannot get an ought from an is. You cannot get a way to think about your behaviors and your actions and your thoughts, how you ought to be, how you ought to do in a given situation in terms of morality, from a naturalistic way the world is. So when we look around the world and we see this is how the world is, it's naturalistic in nature, there's no way to derive an ought from that. There's no way to derive morality from that. So pretty much all philosophers agree on this point. You cannot get philosophically, no matter how much argumentation you provide, rigorously brilliant philosophers you get together, they're not going to come up with a way to get an ought from an is. So in other words, when you have an understanding of how things are, how the universe is, there's no way to derive morality. So that begs the question, what is the source of our morality? What is the source? Christians say, who is the source? The naturalist says what? And ultimately, what we find with philosophy is that the naturalist has no grounding for their moral structure. They have no foundation. They cannot have one, because you cannot get an ought from an is. So, if naturalism is the way the world is and cannot produce any form of morality, then we think of morality is meaningless. And we think morality is meaningless. So with naturalism, that is what you basically conclude, that morality as a whole is meaningless. So James Sire, he confirms Thus, does naturalism lead to nihilism? If we take seriously the implications of the death of God, the disappearance of the transcendent, and the closedness of the universe, we end right there. Nihilism. That there is no ultimate meaning or purpose or morality in the universe. So there's no God, no transcendent, there's no way to get out of the box, there's no way to know objectively how things are the way they are, why they are the way they are. That is how we wind up with nihilism, meaningless. In fact, it's not just a conclusion of naturalism, it is the conclusion of naturalism. There is no other conclusion with naturalism. You have to end up with nihilism. This is a very sad picture if you haven't figured it out. If you are an atheist and you are a naturalist, you ought to be very depressed. Yes, in the back. Sorry? Oh, go ahead, Chris. Go ahead, Chris. Yeah, I love your question. It's just, you know, you start to really think about how they think and how they arrived at where they're at, and sometimes they just go off of the assumption there is no God, and they start there with no argument for that position. With naturalism, you actually have an argument for that position. You have a compilation of evidence from science. You know, just to how you think about the world, how the world actually is. And you arrive eventually with this argumentation to naturalism and being the conclusion. So in that sense, you do have an argument, but you're right. I mean, a lot of people that do not grow up in the church tend to want to consider themselves free thinkers. So most atheists won't call themselves skeptic or atheist. They will call themselves free thinkers, as if to imply that religious people aren't, you know. And so that's just kind of a play with words that they do, you know. So this is an important point you're bringing up, is that the person's presupposition needs to be addressed, and why they hold to their basic position. So with hopefully, you know, your conversations, I know you do a lot of ministry online, hopefully you can help them see that the basis of their position fails. If they aren't agreeing with, say, your line of reasoning towards Jesus of Nazareth, you know. So, yeah, thanks. Thank you. Yeah, you definitely have a weird contradiction where the naturalist says that we have a mind to think about things, but according to their view, we don't have a mind. You know, so the intelligibility of the universe, like you're talking about, is something that they shouldn't be able to address in their with their view. They should not be able to account for, or they can't account for the intelligibility of the universe, that we can understand it and that it can report things to us. So you're right, there's a failure there. We talked about that with the naturalistic critique, so you're right on with that. Yeah, Crystal, yeah. 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 Thank you, Crystal. Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah, a lot of times, if you're meeting up with the right atheist, I should say, he or she may have studied enough stuff to give you some in-depth discussion on any given matter, and it's kind of rare for them to meet a Christian who can discuss at that level. Because you're right, you know, we have most of the Christian evangelical population in a very anti-intellectual mood. And it's a very sad thing, but this is what has happened due to secularization of our culture. Secularization really, really started right around this time. We're talking about Nietzsche at the end of the 1800s. And we really start to see secularization just start to dominate Western culture. And now we live in the aftermath of a secularized world. Just yesterday I heard that it's now in full effect, and this is the law that was put in effect in California to have in public schools the transgender students be able to use the other sex's bathroom because of their orientation.
Yeah, they didn't have enough signatures.
We didn't have enough signatures as the conservative group to raise the other vote. Okay, here's the thing that I heard yesterday. Okay. It's not yeah. Okay, so this is, let's continue to discuss this at the break. I'll leave this in and I'll get out of it. I heard yesterday that the law was passed back last year, and in the meantime, we had enough time to get enough signatures to contest it in a statewide ballot petition, to vote against it, to vote to uproot the law and change the law. But it's not implemented yet because it was in this temporary probation time, I guess. We sent in 650,000 signatures. Apparently, 170,000 were invalid. So I guess the 500,000 cutoff mark wasn't met by about 29,000 signatures or something like this. Okay, 17,000. Okay, so we have some idea of what has happened. Either way, the fact that the state of California Congress could pass a law that allows these mixed and confused children to be in this situation is terrible, but it's only going to lead to even worse problems. You know, once you have guys saying, oh, I'm transgender today, you know, and you just don't want guys in that bathroom. On that note, that lovely note, talk amongst yourselves about the petition at the break. Let's take five. Okay. So you may see this guy who's got a big mustache on your page there. That was Hitler in his teenage years. No, I'm kidding. This was Friedrich Nietzsche. Has anyone studied Nietzsche in school? I bet you have. Here? Okay. Well, German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche was and I'm probably butchering his name, he was a big-time guy in the history of philosophy, not so much for his analytical capabilities, but for his writing in a genre later called the existential genre. So essentially, he was a existentialist philosopher, but he popularized nihilism, and he's someone of great importance to us for this week and next week. So one of his aims was, he aims it, meaning nihilism, to open our eyes to a world without fixed parameters of meaning and truth, and in its place, a raw flux of energy and power. So you take out meaning and truth, and you bring in energy and power. And that's what Nietzsche was about. He wanted to discuss the will to power a lot. But his most famous writing is probably the Parable of the Madman from the Gay Science, section 125. So if you don't mind, coming up, we're going to ask Pele, who has an incredible talent to be an incredible actress, to deliver this passage from Nietzsche in a very provocative manner. I mean, I just prefer someone else to read it because it already has a bit of passion to it. But, you know, I can't read too well, so...
Like a child, ask another, or are you fighting?
Let's give her a hand. Thank you, Paley. Wow, what a powerful passage. This is one of the most famous pieces of literature in Western history anyway, but it's very famous because of his phrase, God is dead. And you may have been struck by many things in this passage as she read it. So we're going to look at a few things, and then we're going to critique nihilism, okay? So let's first, I put some underlines and some bold print there because those are kind of going to relate to the little discussion we're going to have now. So at the first point is the bold items. So the first bold thing, well, let's just say this. Nietzsche is famous for his style, his prose, an incredible existential synopsis of how his present European enlightened culture would inevitably reflect a society that killed God. Okay, so this is kind of the heart of the passage. So in bold there, you see in the passage, what I'm saying here in bold is kind of how to interpret this, is that Nietzsche has often been misunderstood in light of this famous quote, God's too decomposed, God is dead, God remains dead, and we have killed him. So that probably struck you the most. So the way to think about this is as follows. So many people misinterpret him, but basically, Nietzsche is trying to be here a prophet or a messenger or a reporter who investigates culture and then shares what he has learned. So in this sense, Nietzsche is not trying to be someone who is just outright exclaiming, we killed God, he's dead, he no longer exists, just making the assertion without giving an argument. It's not that at all. It's more that he is trying to be a person who examines culture and says, this is what is happening in European culture at the end of the 19th century. And so he's merely being a newspaper reporter in this sense. And he's trying to show everybody that God has ceased to remain believable in this culture. Okay, that's the idea, that God has ceased to be believable in this culture. So when he says God is dead, that's what he means. Now, that's in the bold print. He stressed the importance of realizing what a lack of God means. So in the underlined part of the passage, this is what is happening. Nietzsche stressed the importance of realizing what a lack of God means. So if we go back to the passage and go through that underlined part again, remember how eloquent that was? How could we drink up the sea? Who gave us the sponge to wipe away the entire horizon? Is he talking about is he just making lovely word pictures? No. He's actually talking about how we got rid of meaning, how we got rid of objective morality. Who could drink up the sea? Something as big and powerful as objective morality. Who could get rid of such a thing? Who gave us a sponge to wipe away the entire horizon where you define one thing and another? Who gave us a sponge to wipe that away, to have no horizon to differentiate between moral matters? What were we doing when we unchained this earth from its sun? When we got rid of God, our anchor, if you will, in the universe, the sun being our anchor, so to speak, the life-giving, sustaining energy we have, when we unchained the earth from the sun. What were we doing? Whither is it moving now? Where are we going now that we got rid of God? Whither are we moving? Away from all suns? Are there any gods at all? Are we not plunging continually backward, sideward, forward in all directions? Is there any up or down? How do we know which way is up and down? We don't have any sense of direction. We have no moral compass anymore. Are we not straying through an infinite nothing? Things just are bleak now. We have no sense of right and wrong, good and evil, the light and the darkness. We're just going through this empty space of nothingness. Do we not feel the breath of empty space? Has it not become colder? Is not night continually closing in on us? Do we not need to light lanterns in the morning? Don't we need to have some makeshift artificial way of getting morality into our picture? That is what he's doing there with the underlying passage. So he thought that philosophers should bring themselves to a screeching halt and take a breath and think about the difference that an uncreated world that is godless implied. What is really happening when you have naturalism? He's just trying to inform everybody, hey, look, this is where we're at and this is where we're going. So he wanted to break out of the mold of having a God culture. He kind of liked this scenario. He kind of liked where it was going, frankly. He didn't like being misinterpreted by the Nazis, but because he already felt that happening towards the end of his life. But Nietzsche insisted that without God, purpose and meaning cannot have a basis. So Nietzsche writes, every belief, every considering that something is true or something true is necessarily false, because there is no true world. There is no true world out there that we, when he's talking about moral world out there, that we can base our morality on, that where our morality corresponds to that objective morality. There's no real moral world. All we have is our box. That's all we have. We're just stuck in our box. So there's a long Nietzsche quote there about how morality is just an imaginary thing. It's just nonsense. You see the last word there, nonsense. So I don't want to read through that, but we can continue to go here forward. So that's the idea, is that morality is to be thrown out completely, or is being thrown out completely by that current European culture. Now, in the italics, in the passage, he's saying this, it's too late. We cannot change and go back to a objective morality from a God that exists. So there is no God that exists. We've already arrived at that conclusion with naturalism, and we can't go back to a world, an objective morality world, where God does exist. There's no way to go back. So you see there with those arrows kind of skewing off into endless space there on a skew. You know, with existentialism, everything is kind of on a skew. So that's kind of the idea with this, is that naturalism leads to this idea that God is dead. This is how Nietzsche frames it, and that, of course, leads to nihilism. And then if you have the starting point in culture that there's no God, you have no purpose, no meaning. Also, if there's no God, you have no truth and no morality. So that's just the idea with those diagrams, just to help us see that you are going in this direction and there's no way back. There's no arrow coming back the other way. Once you get rid of God, your culture is going completely secularized. So for Nietzsche, nihilism is the necessary implication of Europe's naturalism. And he also talks about Immanuel Kant, too. And we don't have time to get into that much. I'm not a Nietzsche expert, of course, or a Kant expert. But he does discuss how Kant helped contribute to the rise of nihilism along with naturalism. All right, so the last thing with the double underline at the end of the passage is the metaphysical foundation of European morality was undermined and the moral structure on top of it collapsed. That's what we've already talked about. So if you go back to the little passage there and read that last underline, it says, what, after all, are these churches now if they are not tombs, not the tombs and sepulchres of God? So he's basically saying that once you get rid of the foundation, this God and theology and religion that comes from a knowledge of God, once you get rid of that metaphysical foundation that God exists, he's, according to Nietzsche, this metaphysical-only entity, then you arrive at the conclusion that there are no moral structures, and there's no moral foundation, God himself. In the Christian view, we say that God is the source of all morality. He explains morality, and that objective morals do exist because God exists. That is the Christian view. This is a foundationalist view and a realist view, like we talked about last week. So we have a foundation that God is the source of morality, that goodness stems from his being, and that's a separate thing than his generosity. So keep that in mind. We like to think about whether God is good to us or we're blessed. And because we are or we're not, we say God is being good or, you know, or so forth. That He is a good God because look at all these blessings I have. So His goodness seems to take precedence in these moments of blessing that we have. But in reality, His goodness is ultimately His being itself. God's being itself is goodness. His generosity is a different thing altogether. So whether God is generous or not has nothing to do with His being. His being is ultimately good. It's a good thing that God bees. He exists. And this is a powerful thing when we talk about the being of God and how goodness is ultimately there because He is there. This is a powerful thing for Christian to understand. And generosity being different. So keep this in mind. So what's happening here is that when you get rid of God, then where does goodness originate? It can't originate in its what we thought was the source. So now where do you find goodness? Nature doesn't speak of it. You can't ask nature where the goodness is. Nature does not answer. So what are the implications of nihilism? One, we have despair, which we've already kind of looked at, because after you arrive at the conclusion that we're all going to die a heat death or a cold death, or we're all going to be annihilated when we die and there's no afterlife, well, it tends to lead towards a sense of depression and despair. So we could talk through that a whole lot. It's a very sad picture. But also inequality, and this is where the Nazis came about. When you start thinking of humanity outside of the image of God imparted in us, then you start concluding that we are unequal, that there is a sense of hierarchy due to talents or intellectual capability, you know, things like this, properties of us rather than the essences of us. Our essence is derived from His essence. Augustine said that our being is ultimately derived from His being. So once you have gotten rid of the source of human essence, what makes us human, then how do you explain humanity? You can't. You inadequately explain humanity when you try, because our essence ultimately is derived from His. So then we now have an unequal humanity. And then you lead into hedonism, which is basically the view that anything goes. Anything you feel like doing, do it, because it's all about pleasure. Hedonism says, have as much pleasure in this life as possible and have as minimal amount of pain as you can have. Get rid of all pain and increase all your pleasure. That's what this life is about. And hedonism is the necessary result of nihilism, or it's one of the results, I should say. So anything goes. Do anything you want. Right. Existentialism, then, is also the other byproduct of nihilism. And now we live in a secular postmodern world that embraces anti-foundationalism. We live in an existential world where it's all about us. And it's all about creating meaning and choosing to be free in this world. It's all about creating ourselves, creating our future. So we'll talk about that more next week. So those are the implications of nihilism. Now, what are the criticisms of nihilism? Let's quickly go through this. We'll end in just a few minutes, if you don't mind. Anything goes causes problems. This is the first criticisms we can muster here. So first way to say this is that anything goes type actions still create meaning. And this is what Chris, you were alluding to earlier. So the very process of choosing to act shows there is meaning in the moment, even if it is simply choosing to satisfy an urge or interest. As one can say, I do this because I have an interest to do that, let's say. Let's say I put one foot in front of the other to go to the movies. I have an interest to do it, so that makes my walking meaningful because I have an end result I'm trying to get to, a means to an end. And so my action, so if I'm a nihilist, naturalist, atheist, my actions are still creating meaning, but my worldview denies meaning. So the point is, anything I do, I'm still creating meaning, which is totally contradicting how I think about things. So let's say, if you think about these things, I'm going to go eat 1,000 donuts, then I'm going to go watch a Disney movie, then I'm going to go watch a horror movie, then I'm going to eat 1,000 more donuts, and then go watch another Disney movie and another horror movie, and keep doing this, like 10 straight times. I mean, can you imagine doing that? But that's the idea. Even it seems so meaningless, like what I'm doing. Like, what are you doing? Like, you're going to drive yourself nuts, you know? There's no meaning to what you're doing. You're just doing weird, crazy things on opposite sides of the spectrum, Disney, horror movies. But I'm doing something. It doesn't matter really what I'm doing. I'm doing something. So that doing creates meaning. That's kind of the idea with this. So meaningful actions are created. But according to nihilism, there is no meaning in the universe. So the implication of nihilism, that anything goes, causes contradictions with the core of nihilism that says there is no meaning in anything, including actions. Okay, so that's the idea there. Why would you choose to keep breathing? This is a great question. Why would you drink water? For what purpose? Why should you live right now? Why should you be alive? These are great questions to ask someone who's a naturalist, because that worldview, nihilism, is the ultimate result of their view. Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, if you really share all this with them, they may get really depressed. You know? Say it again?
Why would a mother hen guard her chicks from the approaching fox? Because if she didn't, we'd go strong.
It's good.
Inner drive that makes her keep doing things to live, I think shows that there's some reason.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Their life seems contradicting. Right, but you don't have to choose to drink water, like she was saying.
But the problem with not breathing, if you pass out, nature takes over. So you really don't want to use that.
Yeah. Let's move forward here. Thank you. Right. So when he says meaning is what you make it, he is basically uttering a very existentialist remark. And so what we'll learn here and then next week is that if you take that statement and keep going with it, you ultimately end up with absurdity. So when that happens, usually the original part of your statement needs to be rejected, because otherwise you'll end up in an absurd situation. So we'll see a little bit of that here. Yeah. And our job is to help them point to their own logical absurdity of their own view. Yeah, it's a very fun experience. Well, It's interesting because a lot of times we need to help them destroy their view, because otherwise they'll never be able to build up the Christian worldview. And it's a you know, when you come to the cross, it's the same thing. You have to get rid of your selfishness. You have to do the AA thing. I am a sinner, and I need help, you know. And but this is what is happening. It's a painful moment, so to speak, because that false self needs to deteriorate. Yeah. The Holy Spirit uses that conversation in ways we can't even imagine. It's as predecessors, pre-evangelism.
Jonah and Nineveh.
Yeah.
Same parallels, if you look at it from the standpoint of what we're talking about, what we're saying. The development of this capability, to argue a point, was completed in the belly of a whale. But while he was being completed in his ability to present the word of God, the Spirit of God was at work in the Ninevites to receive the message that he was going to proclaim. So there is never not an operative word of God on the other side of the deal.
Yeah.
Okay? So here you have a whole nation in disbelief. Okay? And God is saying, no, I'm not going to get rid of them. And if he does what he does with Noah. So I think that on a national basis, like with Nietzsche and so on and so forth, and looking at Europe and so on, in contradistinction, we have Bonhoeffer writing Act and Being, the cost of no cheap grace, the cost of discipleship. And you have the confessing church still active until the Nazis took it over, nationalized it. So while the church is there, and the Holy Spirit is operative, cannot lose, irrespective of how we may perceive the argument.
Yeah.
Because the fullness of the Gentiles cannot come in apart from the work of the Holy Spirit, and I don't care how good we are at any of this. It's academic. Because I think that from what you said the other day, help them with their argument. Because it's spurious. And if you help them with it, you'll conclude it quicker for them, rather than trying to find a way to dissuade them.
Yeah. Yeah, like, here's a good example of what you're talking about.
I'm a good example of that.
Paul reasoned with the Jews in the synagogue and with the Greeks in the Acropolis in Athens in Acts chapter 17. He used their worldview that held that they ought to worship all these gods, including the unknown God, when he walked by that statue and it had an inscription to the unknown God. And he took that basic knowledge structure that they had and he brought it out and drew that out and spoke to that. And so that's what we want to do. We don't necessarily always have to try to criticize their walls like this, but oftentimes we do. And so we need to be ready. 1 Peter 3:15, always be ready. Always be ready to give an answer for the hope that lies within you with gentleness and respect. So anyway, we could talk about that more. Let's continue these criticisms so we can finish up here just in a few minutes, okay? So the second thing we could talk about with this anything goes criticism is that anything goes results in opposite moral behavior being equivalent. So Francis Schaeffer, by the way, if you want to read someone, by the way, who does a really good job with this, Francis Schaeffer's book, The God Who Is There, it's about existential theology, but The God Who Is There has some real practical tips to discuss things with people. I think you would really like it based on what you just commented about. So Francis Schaeffer, he uses an example like this. You help, say, someone with special needs cross the street. And then you go down a block and there's another person with special needs, and instead of helping him cross the street, you beat him over the head and you steal their stuff. That's basically Schaeffer's way of saying that this just results in absurdity. Like, When you have no moral structure, you can't differentiate between ultimate extreme goodness and almost good and extreme badness and semi-badness. You ultimately can't differentiate between any moral action at all. So when you do one thing that's completely opposite to the other, it's equivalent in this nihilistic structure. And that's absurd. We all recognize that helping the person with special needs cross the street and then stealing his stuff and beating him with a handbag is just opposite actions. But it results in the idea of them being equivalent because there's no way to differentiate between them. So in both actions, no moral good or evil was done. There are no morals. It's an amoral world, a non-moral world. Both actions were non-moral and had no morality. And this is absurd, and therefore it's to be rejected. And the last thing we'd say about this anything goes, it results in justifying horrific behaviors, which is absurd. So Ravi Zacharias said recently, if you are an accident, so remember when we were talking about how we are cosmic accident, stardust, animated stardust, we're products of the universe, like we went through the universe manufacturing factory, and we just, you know, were created. If you were that cosmic accident, he says, I can wipe you out with an incident. What he's just saying is that anything I do to wipe you out, to destroy you, that is justifiable. Because if you're an accident, it's just as okay for you not to be here. Your life is completely contingent anyway. So why not just destroy it? And this is, you know, getting into Nazi Germany and Stalin's USSR. And basically, that is just as appropriate as everything that Mother Teresa did. So killing the 6 million Jews is just as appropriate as Mother Teresa helping all those from the lower caste. Based on this. And that justifying Mother Teresa's actions and justifying Hitler's actions are equally appropriate because we have no equality. So with this anything goes implication, these things are equally acceptable. And that's what we're saying here. So you can just kind of skip down. There's a couple guys, if you want to really look into some crazy people's thoughts, Steven Pinker and Peter Singer, they're at the bottom there of that last item. If you go study and research those guys and their views, you will be surprised at how they justify how just as we kill fetuses, we ought to be able to kill annoying three-year-olds. That's basically what he says. Well, actually, he says killed newborns up to 30 days. Okay, annoying newborns. So Peter Singer and Steven Pinker, look those guys up and their views. Okay, the other thing here, we can go through this quickly, is that nihilism is unlivable. So what would a life be without meaning? Well, we all would know that this would lead to depression, kind of like what we've been talking about. And meaning is just vital to our lives. Everyone needs meaning. And life is unable to be lived with this level of depression. And so that's the first thing we could say about how nihilism is unlivable. And naturalists really don't take their naturalism seriously. So naturalists do actually affirm values. They do. They actually say things that they do are meaningful when you talk to them. So they're really inconsistent. And the naturalist doesn't seem to care to ask how they know their values, kind of like what you were talking about, Chris, or whether or not their values are good. They don't really care to go there with their thought process. They just assume that what they do and what they value is good. So ultimately, the naturalist has no basis for objective morality. You could clarify that. And they would realize this if they dared to ask. Okay, so ultimately, they would figure this out if they had dared to ask. And see, nihilism practically leads to insanity. So if people consistently act out of meaninglessness, then there are reasons to consider a mental health resolution to the problem, to the situation. Here, this is very touchy, obviously. This is a very sensitive point because mental illness is so pervasive through our society, and many of us may struggle with it. But practically speaking, there's no way to differentiate a nihilist who who's acting out of their nihilism from someone suffering from mental illness, because their behaviors would be equivalent. Any bizarre behavior of the nihilist, like the donuts and the Disney and the horror movies, that sort of thing, and continually repeating that, that would be equal to the person suffering from illness's behavior, oftentimes. Believe it or not, Nietzsche spent the last years of his life dealing with mental illness. He was in a clinic for many years. A very sad situation. His mother and sister kind of had to come and be by his side often. And so he dealt with mental illness, and people that don't know what they're talking about say that he went crazy. You know, they use that expression. Yeah, it's...
And I would suggest to you that that may not only be the case of my perspective, because I do take exception. I think neurosis is a substitute for all legitimate suffering. This is an escape from it. And that can be overcome. The nihilism, in my view, proper transition during the Oedipus phase. There's no object constancy, and that is generated then into the overview of life and the philosophy of life. But there is hope for them to arrive. But I think the nihilism has a journey that is really, really difficult because they view that which should have been there and stable for them, and an object that was constant and loving and transition, they don't do that, did not happen. And so their textual view of God is the same as the important things that were in their life that didn't meet their needs or couldn't meet their needs.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, these things, when we talk about these things being equivalent, their behaviors, that I think I want to differentiate that between the actual situation itself. So a behavior is just showing the absurdity of this thing. But I really hear what you're saying. That's a great point. Okay. Let's finish this up here, if you don't mind. Nihilism denies what our psyche needs. This is a basic point that we can all understand, that nihilism calls for us to deny what we need and desire, to accept that there is meaning and significance in the world. And I think you're kind of speaking to this a little bit, Roger. That we all have these psychological needs for meaning. It's just something that naturally happens. But nihilism rejects what our souls or our body's natural desire is. So it's inconsistent to our very nature to live without meaning. And so that, in this sense, it's inconsistent with nature itself, which is something they try to preserve. And lastly, nihilism self-refutes in two ways. So I hope you have noticed that every worldview we've encountered so far self-refutes. Thank you. That's good news. So it has a lot of problems, each one of these, but the biggest problem is that they self-refute. So the first way is that nihilism assumes meaning to deny meaning. If someone really does deny meaning in the universe, he is going against something. He must assume there is meaning in order to deny it. So James Sire points out, in order to be a practicing nihilist, there must be something against which to do battle. A practicing nihilist is a parasite on meaning. So meaning is present, or they could not deny it. That's what Sire is saying, is that people have to understand something like the word meaning to deny the word meaning, or the concept of meaning, in order to deny it. So they recognize that meaning as a term means something, and then they deny that. So you have to assume it to deny it. That's the idea. So they contend that there is no meaning in the universe, but they intend that this statement is meaningful and wish to convey this statement to us in a way that we will understand it, like in essays or in art, etc. So all of their communication of their view to people assumes several things. That they can convey meaning, that we will understand their meaning, and that their view has meaning otherwise they wouldn't attempt to communicate, as they wouldn't know we would understand the gibberish that they're uttering. These three points show that they assume meaning when they communicate that all is meaningless. So in other words, if you're going to tell me that you view the world as meaningless, you're communicating something and you're assuming that I'm going to understand what you're saying. So in other words, you assume this communication process has meaning transmitted. That is assuming something that you're denying. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Even art that denies meaning is still conveying meaning. So if you go to a modern art museum, you see some funky art. Well, it still has some level of structure in it. Even the wackiest art that's out there, it has some intent of an author. The author is trying to communicate something. Even that something it could be, the world is meaningless. He's still communicating that with meaning. And lastly, it's self-contradicting, so in this sense it self-refutes. So we could say that, but beyond that, the content alone of the view self-refutes, and because they have only one point, that there is no meaning. And so they want to have it both ways. There is no meaning except for this statement, which isn't meaningful. Everything else is meaningless except that statement that I just said. That's what they're saying to us. Your view as Christians is just meaningless. Everything is meaningless except what I just said. So, but if it is true that there is no meaning, then this statement also has no meaning, so we must reject it as meaningless. Therefore, it self-refutes. And with that, we'll go ahead and close. The possible responses portion, I would beg you to read on your own this weekend. It kind of is simplistic in nature. There's nothing too profound there. But the idea, like I mentioned Francis Schaeffer, I quote him right here a couple times, and I talk about him and what his approach is. If you guys ever want to look into somebody that was pretty radical, Francis Schaeffer, a pretty awesome character. So we want to help them, like we've been talking about, use their own worldview to reach some certain conclusions about how their worldview is absurd or self-refuting, if they're willing to listen to that, if we present it appropriately. But there's also some other things that we can now present about the Christian worldview and how meaningful it is and how it gives meaning to everything, and how we have hope in this world because there is an afterlife. That it's not just a heat death or a cold death, and we're not just going to be annihilated. That there is something beyond the grave. And that ultimately informs what we do in the here and now. And oftentimes as Christians, we really tend to forget that Jesus is coming back and that there is a restored kingdom that we can contribute to now, because like Paul said, he's given us the ministry of reconciliation to be co-reconcilators with Christ, to reconcile the entire world back to himself. And N.T. Wright is an author that has done a tremendous job of bringing this point up. If you haven't gotten in touch with N.T. Wright, he is an Anglican bishop, but an incredible biblical scholar. He wrote an 800-page book just on the resurrection that is completely scholarly. And his book, Surprised by Hope, even though it makes some weird statements about salvation, is powerful in this respect, that it talks about having hope and meaning in the here and now, because ultimately we are contributing to our own future and the future of others around us. The Christian worldview is the only worldview I submit to you that does this well or at all. So this is a powerful point about Christianity, and when the meaninglessness reaches the absurdity and someone understands that and understands it self-refutes, now the presentation of the gospel ultimately is incredibly the solution that he's longed for. So and with that, let's close up. Yes, sir. N.T. Wright. N.T. Wright.
So
Yeah, if you want to read more on this, read commentaries on Song of Solomon this weekend. And I guarantee if you read like a few different commentaries, you'll get a real good picture of what that book is. Ecclesiastes, you'll get a real good picture of what that book is trying to do. The annihilation of annihilation, yes. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Will someone mind closing us in prayer? Okay, thanks.